Racehorsemen, subtitled How Slavery and Freedom Were Made at the Racetrack, explores ways in which the 19th century mores of this country were reinforced or challenged in the context of what was then the nation's most popular sport. Catherine Mooney wrote the book, and she joins me from WWNO in New Orleans. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you for having me.
How was the institution of slavery reinforced by the growing popularity of horse racing, and how was it challenged?
Well, I think it was reinforced, particularly in the 1840s and the 1850s, because it really did become a sort of national sport, particularly with the rise of the telegraph. Horse racing became a more national sport because it was easier to get results more quickly. For instance, Abe Hawkins, who's a slave in Louisiana in the 1850s, who would ordinarily have been sort of locally known, become sort of national celebrities, and they're known about in New York. And in a strange way, slaves who were celebrities, in fact, proved that slavery was this cutting-edge institution that could do basically anything, that highly skilled labor could come out of slavery, that they could have industry, they could have international prestige. But particularly in the 1850s, as more and more people sort of start coming into this space, that's when you start to see the cracks. For instance, one of the owners was this man named Robert Harlan, and I thought, well, that's interesting. I wonder if he's related to John Marshall Harlan, the Supreme Court justice in Plessy versus Ferguson. And they were related. And in fact, I later discovered that they were half-brothers, except that Robert Harlan's mother had been a slave. And so he was a free black man who owned racehorses. I looked at that and I thought, that's a place where letting these people in is weakening the institution of slavery, because here is this man who has prestige and he has power, and he's reminding you that blackness and slavery are not the same thing.
On the plantation of a white man who owned racehorses, the black men charged with the care of those horses were slaves, but they were responsible for the plantation's pride and joy, and the masters often deferred to them. What did you learn about how some of those men lived that contradiction?
Many of these guys have really unimaginable privileges that distinguish them from other slaves. They can go basically where they want. They make a good bit of money. They get to give orders to white men. They get to have their opinion listened to. And in fact, the first guy that I ran into and what made me want to do this project in the first place was a guy named Charles Stewart, who worked in Virginia, in Kentucky, and in Louisiana as a slave. He, in fact, bought his first wife, but about 5 years into their marriage, after they'd had three children, he decided to sell her back to the man he'd bought her from exchange for a trotting horse. And when the guy said, well, she's older now, she's had some kids, and he said, oh yeah, I know she has wear and tear on her, so I'll throw in the kids too.
Whoa, what a story.
Yeah. The reason that he threw in the kids was he said, with mares, the mare is 80% of the foal. So, you know, she's no good, so the kids are going to be no good. So he was sort of too good at his job. And that's, in fact, what was really different after freedom, was that that became possible.
In the latter part of the 19th century, Isaac Murphy, a black man, was one of the country's most successful jockeys. He won the Kentucky Derby three times. He was celebrated in the press as, quote, the Prince of Jockeys. Did that status carry over into his life away from the racetrack?
In a way, it did. And there's a really interesting thing that goes on in the later part of the 19th century, particularly with Murphy, though with other people who were almost as well known in that time. Off the track, what they were doing was building lives that they saw very clearly as coming out of slavery. Murphy's born during the war. A lot of his contemporaries, they were small children when emancipation came. But the people who had taught them their jobs had been slaves. And so they built middle-class neighborhoods around racetracks in the South. Their children go to college. They have substantial homes and savings accounts. They appear in the society columns. And you begin to see civil rights activists like T. Thomas Fortune of New York taking pretty serious notice of them and saying, this is what we want in other areas of life. We want fair competition. We want this notion of success.
I'm speaking with Catherine Mooney, the author of Racehorse Men, and you're listening to Only a Game. You write that the centuries integrated world of the racetrack was an intolerable offense to the logic of Jim Crow. Does that help explain how black jockeys, once so numerous and successful, became so scarce?
Yes, I think it does. And it's a very strange thing to watch happening. Barns are integrated. Stable staffs are integrated. Horse races are integrated. Mm-hmm. And then suddenly, and it is sudden, and this is the stunning thing about it, there begins to be this language that filters into the sports press that's clearly coming from the political press that says, oh, well, barns can't be integrated. Black and white people can't work together. That's scientifically impossible. That just doesn't happen. You know, it is racism, but it's a new kind of racism in a strange way. It's fear of free and powerful black people and a black public. And that is sort of a slow incremental process that happens, I think, because of that fear.
Jimmy Wingfield eventually made a great success overseas as a jockey. Mm-hmm. Was his success less threatening to whites in England and Europe than it had been in the U.S.?
They don't seem to have made a fuss about it at all. It's interesting. The French, in fact, were fascinated by him. They loved him. And he was actually a friend of Josephine Baker's. And there's an interesting parallel there, I think, mm-hmm. that, you know, they were fascinated with her as well. It was just a totally different set of racial codes. And so they really didn't talk about it. And in fact, during World War II, when he escaped the Nazis with his family and he came back to the United States, and he went to the track to make a living because that was what he knew how to do, and in fact became one of the first people to give him out to Bill Hartack, who later won 5 Kentucky Derbies. So he had a good eye for talent, even as an older man. His son had a great deal of difficulty adjusting because he'd been born in Europe, and he found American racial codes just horrifically restrictive, especially because their family at that point was interracial, and they couldn't admit that in public. But I hope that African-Americans do continue to know that they have this very proud history, and the community has done a lot of really good work in preserving it, and I hope that continues to be the case.
Catherine Mooney is the author of Racehorse Men, How Slavery and Freedom Were Made at the Racetrack. Catherine, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Oh, thank you so much.